Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy!
I wanted to ask you right from the beginning, I know about a month ago or so, your channel was hijacked from you by crypto bros, right?
That's right, yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me about that.
So, I had everything set up through two-factor authentication, right? Like a lot of people assumed I talked to, they're like, man, you got to set up two-factor authentication. I'm like, dude, I'm not an idiot. I'm already well and above beyond. So,
you had two-factor authentication.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I did. So yeah, I guess I woke up one morning and getting messages from everyone. They're like, hey, you've been hacked. And, so I was kind of fucked, to say the least.
Were they able to get into your email and then your YouTube account? Is that what happened?
Correct. Yeah, they got into my email, changed my email. They totally changed how two-factor authentication could happen. Google has like no customer support at all. This is mm-hmm. another thing to tie into this. This is weird. Google, if you're listening to this, what the fuck, man? So Google has something called like Google Ads. So like, say you have a website and you want to host ads on it. You know, they have a service that you can do that. I'm banned. I've never done it in my life. I have never used Google Ads like to host ads on a website in my entire life. And I've been banned. Like every time I go on there, they're like, you've been like banned for bypassing like restriction, whatever. I'm like, I have no fucking idea what that means. Anyways, I even attempted to contact customer support for that. Lo and behold, Google has no customer support at all. Like it's not a thing. Then and now, Lewis Walker from Then and Now, he great YouTube channel. If anyone is, I'm sure you're familiar with him as well.
I wouldn't be able to tell you one of his videos like off the top of my head, but I definitely am subscribed to him, and I remember his videos being very high quality. I think you mentioned this to me when we first met, that you know, when you start making YouTube videos, you start watching YouTube a lot less. I'm kind of victim to that same situation, yeah. But I am familiar with a lot of the YouTubers. I'm wondering, I guess I was watching, I think it was not your most recent video, but the one prior about psychopolitics, and you go through this portion where you talk about neoliberalism. And I've read books on, you know, that are criticisms of neoliberalism. I've heard many, many interviews of critics of neoliberalism. But there were certain things that you had said in that brief synopsis that I thought were some of the best ways to explain why neoliberalism is just destructive and a poorly constructed system, essentially. And I'm wondering where you got these criticisms, if you kind of started at some point in your life to notice that, you know, our infrastructure is crumbling and so on, or if you actually started to read about neoliberalism and then you said, this is kind of why.
No, that's also a really good question. Even before I really got into theory, critical theory and philosophy, yeah, I was definitely a big critic. I've always been fairly left-leaning, I think, majority of my life. I remember, quote-unquote, politics for me. I started kind of forging through kind of how I thought about a political world in like eighth grade or whatever. It was during the Obama and Romney race or whatever. And mm-hmm. I think even at that point, you know, my eighth grade self was like, God, Republicans really fucking suck. And, you know, I was like kind of, you know, kind of going through there. So I think through time, I've only grown probably more, I guess, left-leaning in how I view the world, as far as, you know, worker emancipation, social emancipation for minority groups, whoever, whatever you want to define what kind of left-wingism is, it's always kind of been a thing. And I think with that, I was always critical of neoliberalism. It's always been a disturbing thing. I was always interested in philosophy and theory, right? I've always had like a bit of grounding in it. It was only then to where I started delving into critical theory that I was understanding there was a language and there was an approach to a critique of neoliberalism that was so much more accurate and so underdeveloped, it was not very understood amidst most people who partake in politics or who study politics or who are quote unquote political. I think critical theory is just so much more, and philosophy as a whole, so much more capable of, I suppose, really understanding the underpinnings and how systems frameworks work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think a lot of how we conduct politics today is through the guise of talking about politics. And that's not the same thing as doing politics. I think political commentary is an incredibly popular thing on YouTube. It's like incredibly popular right. thing in the 80s for radio. It's been a thing that we are popular about, or it's always been popular, right? I think what happens is that it sort of sublimates downward a type of, I want to say, like, genuine type of pacifism. It's a type of it kind of cripples any type of intellectual movement or actual like activist based movement and stuff like that.
Talking about the commentary disengages people from the yes. immediate environment?
I think very, very frequently it does. I think what's even worse about it, this is the bad part. And I'm not saying like all commentary is bad. I almost think it's mm-hmm. not as simple as that. It's not like political commentary by default is some bad thing. It's just that this is kind of a bad byproduct of the system that we're working within, which is capitalism, commodification of commentary and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's a systemic based thing. It's not purely an individual thing. Politics, how we view electoral systems, while I don't think this is concrete 100%, for the most part, though, it is a type of just image-based thing. You have a new person elected. You have another person running for said position. And what happens through the cycle is it's a new cycle of different images, signs, symbols, some towards emancipation, some towards the freedom of minority groups. And then the other is a very reactionary type of thing, right? Which is, at this point, I want to say, like, pretty much fascist. But at the end of the day, mm-hmm. the system itself tends to stay the same. Thus, I guess, in a way, politics, as we describe it today, is a type of entertainment-esque system, right? It's not a real concrete.
Seems to be, yeah.
I guess I approach things through a sort of positivistic lens of politics is the best way to describe it, where I, you know, sort of ushered through existing frameworks and I look through politics that way, which I think our existing framework for the most part is I want to say probably in today's world, a type of technocratic liberalism.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be increasingly technocratic.
Yeah.
And people seem to, from my perspective, lean more into that or desire that technocracy out of a sense of ease.
Yeah.
And it's easier to let leaders and AI and experts take care of the problem. So I agree with you. It reminds me of a lot of Baudrillard's criticisms.
That's right.
Of contemporary United States capitalism, everything really, Western world.
Yeah, I wish I would have phrased that in the terms of Baudrillard, because that's actually exactly what I mean. It's based within the type of postmodern image of mm-hmm. how everything is sort of conducted. I don't think that's 100% the case. I know for a lot of people who are sort of into critical theory themselves, I want to say maybe through the post-Marxist lens, that's kind of how they view politics as something that is purely based within almost the imaginary realm of symbolism and totally away from any material referent of genuine freedom or emancipation and by way of material issues or anything like that. I always kind of say this, it shocks people sometimes, but I do this almost because politics and how we conduct it doesn't matter as much as like mutual aid. I think mutual aid is really like one of the most important things. Like
I agree completely.
Yeah. I think like actual like core organizing is the most important thing we can do. I don't think that's a radical thought. I think that's a conclusion a lot of people think, and I think that's good. But I think as far as electoral systems and how we conduct voting and stuff, it's going to piss people off because there's a lot of moralism in this field. But I just vote Democrat across the board. I look at politics as for what it is. If there is some sort of small little input that can happen, I go ahead and take the path of least resistance on that end of things, whatever is the best. And I do that ironically because electoral systems don't mean as much as they should. Whoever might be the most sympathetic, quote unquote, sympathetic or lax, or who can expose, so say, for example, someone like Bernie Sanders got in office, who can expose the futility of the system as a whole, right? I don't think Bernie Sanders would have been able to do much in office. Mm-hmm. Whoever can do that, do it. I think that's good. I think keeping right wingers in office is not a good thing.
Definitely. Just the small difference, or not even really a small difference, but I think from what I'm hearing you say is very much a pragmatic, very similar to what Noam Chomsky talks about, how, yeah, these people are imperialists, yeah, and they are colonizers, and they are very biased because of their wealth and so on. But nonetheless, and I'm talking about neoliberals or liberals, but nonetheless, they're not actively trying to create segregation between races, or they're not actively trying to, or directly at least, in their rhetoric, trying to ostracize marginalized groups like trans people, for instance, which is right, what the Republicans are actively doing. So yeah, you have to take the small victory and go with it, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think as far as Noam Chomsky goes, that type of strategy, he probably places way more importance on it than I do, but that's roughly kind of what makes the most sense to me. Mm-hmm. I think he stresses that as something that's very, very important. I don't know if I quite do. I don't think I'm as far into that approach. He may still probably put a little bit more stock into electoral systems that perhaps I do, but yeah, roughly. I mean, yeah, it's the same.
They're definitely flawed. I'm not trying to seem like a proponent of vote and that's it. Yeah.
No, of course not. So I know there was a time where, God, like maybe a year ago, Noam Chomsky was getting grilled for saying that exact thing on a podcast. What was it? The, Breonna Joy Gray. Yeah. So I think even spending that much time on that question itself is pretty meaningless. Like, I think that conducted like a type of dialogue throughout the whatever. Again, it doesn't really matter anyways. It's just like on social media and on the internet as is. But I think being angry that Noam Chomsky said this, or even being angry that someone like Breonna Joy Gray would have the mm-hmm. viewpoint that you should vote third party or whatever. I think even having a base dialogue as a way of like some productive polity is just weird. It's so fucking bizarre. It's mm-hmm. I think it's morbidly online, and I think it's a little bit disturbing that actually happened. But I know that this is, and I don't mean to, it's not about moralizing some individual. It's not. Like, I know people are like, you know, they don't like some political commentator over some intellectual like Breonna Joy Gray or Noam Chomsky. It's not about that. It doesn't ever matter. I think even that people focus their little time that they have on Twitter or on the internet by focusing on things like that, it's really juvenile, and I think it's really
there is a gratification from sending out a political tweet, for sure.
Yeah, well, that's a good point too. There's that other angle of it. Again, I know on our channel, I think you're a psychology person, but you know, I think within critical theory, psychoanalysis is a pretty relied upon sort of method of looking at stuff. And there is a type of enjoyment, or again, in a Lacanian definition, for anyone who's not familiar in your channel, Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, but his concept of jouissance being like a pleasure and pain, right? Like a, there's a type of enjoyment that we get from partaking in a type of crusade-like struggle, something that hurts us. And I like, honestly, I see this within political commentators. Political commentators, they're constantly in crisis mode because someone said something about them and they're doing something. And and no doubt it probably stresses them out. No doubt it's terrible for their health, but they do it anyways. And
it's, it's an addiction, I believe. You know, it gets you jazzed up for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's understandable. And back to how we conduct dialogue as liberals, like we like, this is the other thing too. I'm not big on the ideological idea. This is, I think this is in some ways a very, positivistic liberal ideal, that like we can, I can say verbally, I'm a leftist, I'm a communist, I'm a socialist, if I'm a right winger, I'm a fascist, whatever. Saying that doesn't really mean anything. I think the framework that you live in, the system that you live in, I think it has much more bearing on you than what your ideological sort of...
Yeah, you're predisposed because of the circumstances to be a liberal,
exactly. And I think this is the silly part that you'll see on the internet. This is something that I'll never partake in this. I'll never call someone some stupid liberal on the internet. I'll never call, like, you're not a real communist, you're not a real Marxist. What does that mean? Like, what are you saying whenever you say stuff like that? Because I think at the end of the day, I think the system that we live in, we are all liberals. We live in fenced in backyards. We have individual homes. We have, even in the United States, we have cars that we drive on our own. We are a type of liberal that is isolated. We take upon a material form of sort of liberal political theory of like isolated individuality and stuff like that. So I think that the framework that we live in, whatever, I think that makes a way bigger difference than your own ideological sentiments. Anyways, who was it? Jordan Peterson would talk about fucking what, railing against liberals. Jordan Peterson, in so many ways, how he got his, I don't know what, Jordan, he's on a whole other level now.
I've heard you talk about him. In fact, you've kind of thrown some jabs in one of your videos that I was watching recently at him. So,
yeah, I mean, I think even in his early stuff, he didn't really have any idea what he's talking about whenever it comes to philosophy at all. Like, I know the easiest thing to point out with that is, you know, he had a debate with Slavoj Žižek. And like,
yeah, I remember that.
Reading the Communist Manifesto the night before, that's like all he read. It's like the Communist Manifesto is like hardly like that's not even like
entry level.
Oh, it's not even I almost don't even consider it that. I think if like you want to like understand like sort of the framework of Marxism, like not even the Communist Manifesto is really going to help you much. Like, it can understand sort of the political aims, but I find that very different from like Marx's writing on alienation or the German ideology with him and Engels. It's just so, yeah, it's hardly even like, you know, in some ways it's almost like a piece of, I've heard it phrased this way. I know this has a negative tonality. I don't mean it like that. It's almost a piece of like political propaganda in a way. And I think that's actually like really what it is. And that's very different from theory. So he had no idea he has no idea about that. And I think that's like best case scenario. Nowadays, I like don't even know what the fuck's going on with that guy now.
He seems to cry a lot on the internet, and he's gotten into these interesting circles where he's really just a neoliberal extremist or radical neoliberal to an extreme.
I almost at this point, I don't even consider him like a neoliberal. I consider him like really like a proto or quasi-fascist, But I mean,
right, for sure. I just mean economically, because he apparently, and I don't know if there's any documentation of this, he's got Koch brothers funding. So, you know, he's pro capitalism, unfettered capitalism to an extreme. Right. But yeah, socially, absolutely, a lot of fascism going on there.
Yeah, well, I want to say maybe if I could even add to that. No, I think you're right, though. I mean, that's definitely, like, as far as his economic politics goes, I almost think actually, though, and we're seeing this shift across the board, like, I don't even know if Peterson could be considered maybe like a, and a lot of right wingers, like someone like Matt Walsh, could be considered like neoliberals, because they were the big thing now with a lot of right wingers. I think they really are, like, I think this is good, because I think it's like whatever language you want to define this, if you want to call it a dialectic, or if you want to call it whatever the trajectory of the political happenings of the world. I think they're kind of like in favor of controlling the market by way of the state now. Like Tucker Carlson has been talking about, like, there's that clip with him and Ben Shapiro, like he would ban trucking companies from being able to use automated vehicles. And I think this is amazing, because now we're getting at the point of actually really where their core thing is. It's not about
protectionism.
Not even almost that. It's like, again, we're getting more close to the type of again, baseline fascism of a type of merging of corporation and state by way of ushering in some type of social good. I think Peterson's talked about that as well, like banning certain things that are, you know, even if the free market dictates it or whatever. Like, I almost see a really heavy push away from like free markets as they are with a lot of right wingers. And I think it's a big thing when you're hearing right wingers talking about stifling a free market in favor of, you know, like banning drag races or banning some type of thing that involves economics in favor of like moral purity. Like, I think that's where we're getting to the locust of fascism there. So, yeah.
You said you wanted to maybe touch on Adam Curtis, because I mentioned him earlier.
Oh, no, we can go wherever. I'm totally cool with whatever. I've actually never watched Adam Curtis, but this is bizarre. I've never seen Adam Curtis, but I understand what he's doing. The type of a type of politics or a political like happening through a way of art and away from identification and language. That's roughly my understanding of something like that is through Adorno, Theodore Adorno, the
very much
escape. And I'm a big fan of that, escaping politics through way of like positive language. Like, I'm like, I'm a communist, you're a fascist, or I'm whatever I prescribe myself to be, that kind of thing. I like the idea of politics that isn't too direct with itself, because it lends itself to a more, it lends itself and opens itself up to a more imaginary, fruitful realm of things. And I know that can be a little like, okay, whatever, man, like that's kind of, you know, okay, whatever, essentially, that's not grounded in reality as we know it. But I think even the concept of reality itself isn't that. There's a lot there, but I think that's the thing too, is like neoliberalism, the realm that we're roughly living within, we're now living in the decay of neoliberalism, but when we were embedded in it without that decay, without that same type of decay that we are experiencing today, it's a calcifying thing, right? And within calcification, I think imagination is particularly stifled, and I like the idea of having like a documentary or putting out a type of politics that isn't grounded in the same direct language, right? It's almost too easy. I think whenever things too easy like that, you can't impart a type of substance. My favorite video I've ever made, it isn't like a video. It was, I don't know if you've seen it. This is bar none the hardest video I made. It was one I cared about the most. It's called Decay into the Future, a 21st Century American Retrospect. It was kind
of just watched it this morning.
Really? Did you? That was
where it's just a collage of speeches and I thought it reminded me of Adam Curtis, believe it
That's
or not. I
don't says.
Because if you watch any of his stuff, even though he does narrate it, he does have certain documentaries where he isn't talking. So it's just a montage.
That's exactly, that's kind of why I, that's coming up on a year, actually. I think the 12th of April, it will be 1 year since that video's out.
I loved it, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I put my heart and soul into that. And I still like that. That video itself is like, that video means a lot to me as far as like what I was able to do. And it turned out, I thought it turned out pretty well. Better than what I
was excellent.
Thank you. I think stuff like that's important. One, not identifying politics within pure language. I think that's can be a calcifying way of looking at things. And then two, I'm pretty big on I guess what we could describe as hope. I am not a pessimist at all. I don't know if I'd consider myself an optimist either. I feel like optimism is a bit naive, but even within the kernel of optimism and how we think of optimism, that's a bit of where I'm at. And I'm not that grim about the future. I think it is equally as like, honestly, like I mean this, it's
even considering climate change.
Yeah. Even considering climate change. I mean, we might all die to the climate change, like the world, like we may not actually succeed, you know, and that's a scary thought. I think the problem with that is that life itself, I have to be careful because climate change is definitely probably the biggest thing that we're dealing with as humanity, and we should do whatever we can to do so. So I have to be a little direct with this language. It's kind of complicated, and this might be a little bit beyond of what I'm able to express with my own language. I'm a bit stupid sometimes, but I think that life itself, we think of things in the and the future sense a lot. I think life itself, like what we do now, actually, like that matters a lot. And if that does matter a lot, that means that we have to be careful about how we feel and how we are conducting ourselves. So I'm big on Spinoza's concept of affect, which is roughly like, in simple terms, I feel like it's like a sociological, emotional type of thing. It's something like you feel in such a way, and that feeling imparts another feeling on someone else. There's an affect going on, something that's interconnected. And I'm kind of the opinion that joy is a huge important thing in that. When you are cynical and when you are negative, it's not only like one, like you're unhappy, that sucks, but like you are pacified completely. You have no bearing in anything. Spinoza kind of theorizes that like movement, like people who are depressed, like when we think about people who are depressed, they just kind of sit around, they mope around, right? And he noticed that. He thought that that was like almost like a physical, you know, like he took that approach from like a physicist-esque perspective, right? He was like the unhappy consciousness of people is pacifying. There's almost like a physical affect to that where you're immobilized. And so I look at that like where we can use that type of language to describe something like climate change. I don't think we can allow ourselves to fall into that. Not necessarily because one, it would be bad if we did fall into it, but one, it's not true. Look at like all, or I don't like using the word true, but it really like is hard to, I think it's hard to come to the conclusion that we as a humanity don't care about that, or we're all going to die. I think like there's a lot of people doing a lot of different things for climate change, especially our generation and stuff like that. I believe in humanity a little bit more, and whether that belief is naive or not, fair enough. It might be.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. I think that it is, we could be fatalistic about it. But that would do no good for sure. Yeah. And might as well do something and keep it in mind. And I agree that there are efforts being made and a lot of conversations being had.
I think roughly I'm of the mind that I think a lot, there's a lot of data to support this too. Like a lot of sociological data on how like our, like Gen Z conducts politics. Like there, there's some sociological theory that talks about, I learned this in a history class at least, where we can kind of like impart a type of ethos on generations. So the great generation or the whatever, the World War One generation of Americans were more activist in their politics. And then you have a flipping where it becomes a more institutional politics. We've had institutional politics from generation to generation, whether that be Gen X is probably the worst, to the baby boomers. It was an incredibly corporate bureaucratics type of a systematic way of conducting politics. Now that's changing. So the framework itself is flipping. And there's even like, when you look at how like Gen Z, I think there's been some polling data on how Gen Z looks at politics. We're apparently like the most, according to that sociological definition, the most activist-ish generation in American history. And that
definitely seems like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think even there's been some, and I can't quote the exact study. This was actually my last semester of my undergrad. I was talking to a professor, one of my history professors, about this. There seems to be a decent amount of data supporting that as well. And I think that's true. I think, you know, you'll hear an internet terminology. I think the kids are all right. They're, I think we're doing okay. And, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a doomerist. I'm not into that. I think right. The concept,
I actually, it's a breath of fresh air hearing that, I gotta say, because
I hope,
as somebody who is hypercritical of systems, you know, myself, definitely you can get into the funk of kind of just looking at things as if, from very much like Nietzschean perspective of,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, pessimism, you know,
that
like everything's kind of, this is the best it's going to be, and it's going to be downhill from here.
I'm going to be honest. That approach is a bit newer to me. Ernst Bloch is a Marxist philosopher. I made a video, The Philosophy of Hope. That kind of changed. It actually kind of changed my life a little bit. Not all philosophy does that. Like, you know, I was a much more cynical person, and I hope for people, take the concept of hope seriously. And I don't mean to shamelessly, I really don't mean to shamelessly pump my own videos out there, but,
please do. I mean, that's why we're talking to you.
Well, yeah, for anyone who's curious to see what I mean by a type of a Marxian hope or whatever you can call that, I have a video on it. I can explain it way better in that video than here. So that might be a resource of what we're talking about right now. But I'm very big on the process of hope. God, we live on a fucking rock in the middle of a universe we don't know dick about. Like, we, like, you know what I mean? Like, we, you know,
so
there's a lot of cool things. Fuck, man. Like, whenever I'm done with this, I have to upload a video, and I'm going to go play some fucking video games. I'm going to play Resident Evil 4, the remake. That's fucking awesome, isn't it? I think that's cool. You live in, right? You live in a really cool area where, like, you can just go. There's a lot of cool shit, right? There's a lot of cool shit where I live. And this isn't to, like, say that, you know, people who are in really dismal positions shouldn't feel anxious about those positions. It's just that there's ways in which we can approach this that actually makes sense, and it isn't some naive self-help fucking guru bullshit or quasi spiritual religious dumb fuckery. I think it's real. I think it's real. I think it has a genuine basis. Yeah.
Right. I agree. And yeah, not to take away from people who are experiencing pain and hopelessness, but yeah, I agree. In fact, I agree, and I think that oftentimes the people that are in situations that are the most hopeless seeming seem to have the most optimism.
Yeah,
historically, because that's just kind of evolutionary almost.
There's a
learn to live in situations that are, you adapt
Right. I apologize. I hope I didn't interrupt your
thought. No.
There's a book I haven't read. I'm really tempted, but I understand the thesis. It's called There Is No Unhappy Revolution. I think that is just, that is absolutely 100% where I fall into. You can't conduct a level of change, a level of anything while you're cynical, while you're unhappy. Every revolution has to be happy. Like, I really believe that. I know I actually made a video on why happiness is a very ideological construct. I still think that. I don't think this is another way that I came to this conclusion, is that, like, quote unquote, happiness is very ideological. I don't think the goal should be, we're human beings, man. Again, we live in a fucking rock in space. We shouldn't be happy. But I think that how they're using the term, there is no unhappy revolution. We can't conduct new novel things from the perspective of raw, unfettered cynicism, of hate of our current system as is. And I think this is important because, like, even like, I know as leftists, I'm talking a little bit of subtext within Marx. You don't have to be Marxist to be a leftist, I don't think. Like, that's not a thing, but some people think that, and that's whatever. Anyways, through the basis of Marx itself, though, this is an important thing, I think, that a lot of people miss. Marx didn't, like, hate capitalism. He didn't, like, there was no, like, to Marx, there was no hatred. Marx is very non-moralistic with how he approached things. Marx thought that capitalism was the greatest system that we've ever had since then. That's really important, because I think that a lot of people do conduct a level of hatred of capitalism. And what you find from that is a type of cynical moralism on individuals. Like, it's not, The horrible things that happen in the world isn't because of necessarily evil fucking people. That's not it. It's systemic. It's something embedded within the cycle of capitalism as a whole. That's fucking important, I feel like. You can disagree with it, maybe.
The banality of evil.
Yeah, exactly.
What was her name? I'm totally spacing it.
Hannah Arendt.
Yeah, Hannah Arendt. Yeah. Space it for some reason, but yeah, that these systemic problems are banal, and they just kind of happen because we're doing our jobs, and we end up accidentally burning the forests.
So I know one thing, there's a lot of moralism on whether you adopt the type of aesthetics of leftism within like I remember during the, so I don't want to say too much, I don't want to ever talk about any of my activism on the internet. I remember during the George Floyd protests, particularly, there's a lot of like, fuck cops. And so, well, I agree. The institution of police is just, I'm for pretty much abolishment of prisons and police forces. You said you're pretty anarchic, and I am too.
I'm an abolitionist as well in terms of prison.
Yeah. But I don't hate like individual police officers. I don't like.
They're just people fucking trying to do a job.
Yeah, exactly. And it isn't like void of. It's not like a, when you say that, it's not like an absence of like guilt and or whatever. You're not absolving individuals of doing terrible things or anything like that. I think it's just that it doesn't do anything to talk about the issue of police officers from the perspective of like the individual within the police force. Here's another thing that I think there's particularly bad examples, and we can do that. Same with police officers and landlords. I don't think necessarily like being a fucking landlord's like the worst thing. Like, you're like some fucking evil entity. You're partaking in a pretty terrible practice, right? Within capitalism, a lot of people have inherited property and their landlords. A lot of people have whatever. They don't lack the type of language to even understand the type of moral thing that they're imparting on tenants.
Yeah, they don't understand it, or oftentimes.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's important to phrase, and everyone knows a police officer, everyone knows a landlord. And I think that's important too. Like, I'm speaking on optics. On that perspective, like, be careful on how you conduct your language in that regard, because a lot of these people, they care about those people, and they're human beings as well. Again, doesn't absolve the shitty things within the system, but the point is, it's just not about moralism on an individual level. It's systemic, and
I think definitely you have to separate the institution from the individual.
I hope someone who does feel particularly enraged and the way we conduct property in the U.S. and the way that we conduct law enforcement in the U.S. hears that, and they're not like, "Oh, you're ultra apologetic." Fuck no. Like, I think two of the most abysmal things within capitalism is the police force and how we conduct property rights and stuff like that. It's horrendous. It's you know, but. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not a Marxist. In some ways, I don't even describe myself as a Marxist, and we can get into that later or wherever. But that is the thing that within Marx, I am very much like in line with. I don't like to look at capitalism as some like inherently moralistic entity at all.
So I wanted to bring up you said theory and philosophy or philosophy and theory, and it reminded me of Theory and Philosophy, the channel, David's yeah. channel. And I know you guys know each other, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know David.
Yeah, he's incredible. He's probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met.
That dude has videos on fucking everything. Like, yeah. He's been a resource for my videos in the past as well.
Yeah, I think he has one of the most valuable channels on YouTube, and yeah. he's so humble about it as well.
Absolutely.
And I like that you both make philosophy very accessible to not just people who, let me say this, you make philosophy very accessible to people who have no idea about philosophy, but also to people who have time to read these things and do read these things, but maybe see them in a different way. And that's one of the strongest values, I think, that come from philosophy YouTube channels, right?
Yeah.
I almost said philosophy tube. But I have noticed my co-host and I recently got in this hour and a half long debate between each other, not on the podcast or anything, but we got in this hour and a half long debate about, you know, you were talking about Hegel and how his ideas are very, very abstract, very difficult to read, very difficult to understand. And my co-host, Ashok, he says, well, yeah, this is the tradition and this is the language that's used. It's like any other profession and scientific practice, like it has its own language. And I'm like, okay, yeah. Like in psychology, for instance, you could read some of the, you know, top level studies, and it's written in like sixth grade level reading or writing skills, right? So everybody can understand it because these resources are supposed to be for everybody. But philosophy, just even under philosophy undergrads, they start to write in this code almost, and it becomes completely useless unless you know what it is. So it's kind of keeping it a very elitist practice. And I'm curious to hear your perspective on that. Do you think that's okay? And I understand the purpose for it as well to a certain extent, but I'd like to know your perspective on that. Do you think that that should be broken down? Do you think it's okay to continue that tradition? Or do you think it's just a matter of circumstance, like it just happened and that's how it will be forever?
No, that's another great question. Actually,
sorry to be long-winded, by the
no,
way.
No, that's totally fine. So I have a bit of a history with that as well. My early videos that I look at now are quite, I feel like, kind of quite bad. Like my worst video, I feel like I did this because I wanted to make philosophy as accessible as possible, like as accessible as I could. I made videos on Soren Kierkegaard and Simone de Beauvoir. I thought about making the de Beauvoir Ethics of Ambiguity again because it's particularly, it's just not.
She's
it's
excellent. Not,
oh, she's awesome.
I have a signed copy of one of her books.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm. I'll have to, after our interview, I'll show you.
That's so cool, actually. That's wonderful. That's sick.
Randomly found it at a bookstore.
What the fuck? You found a fucking, what the fuck, man? Oh my, wow.
It was the one awesome. About gender differences. It's like a very early feminist writing.
The Second Sex?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's the one.
It's the really big book of hers. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like this thing.
Right, right. That's a big one. The ethics of ambiguity, I made a video on, and I tried really hard to make it like easy to understand. And I thought I butchered a lot of it in trying to make it as accessible as possible. That said, I think that approach is always important. That's the whole point of my channel, actually, is to make this stuff a lot easier to understand. I've noticed it's hard to navigate that line. It's very difficult because you are dealing with philosophers who have very abstract language with stuff. And I've noticed I've had to kind of take a back foot on accessibility at times because there's no way. Like Hegel, you know, it's funny. A funny thing about Hegel said, there were students of Hegel who were like, dude, I don't understand what the hell you're saying. He said, I can't say it any other way. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I feel like maybe I'm wrong on this, but if you can't elaborate on your philosophy in any other way, in any type of other language, I don't know. I would caution to maybe rethink some things, but maybe that's my own dumb whatever. But he was famous for saying that. And there are some cases where it is notoriously difficult. And as a video creator who, God, I make a living doing this, nowhere near enough. I am morbidly underpaid and poor, but in doing so, it's tough to navigate that line. And that's a good question. I'd like to find, I know this is a cheap out answer. I'd like to find myself somewhere in the middle where you can't sacrifice the content of philosophy that's being, you know, put out there. Right. Cause then it's not what you're talking about. It's incorrect, I suppose, in a way, but at the same time, yes, there is I think there is a deep need to democratize philosophy in a way. And I think that's a real thing when you think about how philosophy is conducted. I think it is inherently classist. Like it is. Like I don't think I can say that philosophy isn't, you know, like you got to think about how the origins of academia came about. And it seems to be we have followed a type of tradition where it is just very difficult to make accessible. And that sucks. I think we should try to make it more accessible. And we're kind of a little bit fucked. It's going to take a lot to deconstruct that type of language and stuff. But that is something I care about. My Twitter, for example, I've gotten some flack in how I conduct social media. I believe it or not, this is so stupid.
How so?
This is hilarious. I've heard from people that this is so, I can't even take this seriously. It's the greatest thing. I've had like quite a few comments saying like, I'm surprised if like your videos, you talk, you speak in the way that you do on like Twitter and Instagram. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? Like, what do you mean? Like, I guess they're like, you don't conduct yourself like a philosopher. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh, wow. So you're supposed to be stoic and have a accent, transatlantic. Accent.
I don't know. I've gotten that more than you would think, like probably 5 or 6 times. Like if you think about that, I've been doing this for like 3 years. The fact that I've had that comment like 5 or 6 times, like what the fuck? That's almost disturbing. That's a lot.
Wow.
I think some people, they feel very entitled. You've maybe felt this before, perhaps. People feel entitled to the content that they consume. They feel that there is an entitlement and a thing of control. Just yesterday, I probably shouldn't have even responded to this. People almost feel very like entitled to a level of like communication, like with content creators. Like they're like, mm-hmm. Like that you owe them to like respond and stuff like that. I've never thought to like message Linus from Linus Tech Tips. Hey man, hey Linus, like, you know, like, what do you think about this? Like whatever. And like, if he doesn't respond, I get pissed. Anyways.
I like that you brought up in your Noam Chomsky video, actually, that he literally responds to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if this is just being a Midwesterner or whatever, but I'm always the same way. I always try to respond to whatever I can. I've just noticed there's such a bizarre way in which some things are conducted online. Like, truly, like, Hopefully it's not too Joe Rogan-ish.
No, I agree completely.
DMT, man.
So I guess I'll probably start headed towards the end of our interview, just to keep thing. I don't want to keep you too long. And
sure.
And just for the sake of, I know people only watch certain percentages of things, problem, you know. Man. But I think so far I've really enjoyed our conversation. But I want to ask you two more questions. Going back to YouTube, since we're both YouTubers, I think it would be important now that we've covered stoner philosophy. To mention, what impact do you hope your channel has on the wider philosophical community? Maybe not just philosophy as a practice, but the philosophy of the world. I mean, because you do have 50,000 fans and over a million views now, which means that your thoughts do impact people to a certain extent. And I would like to understand what impact do you hope your channel has, I guess?
That's a great question. That's kind of cool to think about. I hardly think about that at all. 50,000 people, that's nuts. But you're right. I think, and this is pretty true even from the beginning, look at philosophy as something that's radically creative. Like I almost like not even just philosophy. Like, think about the things that you do from like a very creative perspective. I think that's like, God, if there's one thing that I think how we conduct society, our economic systems, is it is rigidly not creative in many ways. Like, we don't value creativity. We do, right? We only value creativity when it can be siphoned into categories and something that can be marketed, sold, you know, and it can become a commodity within itself. But I think that really kind of kills an element of creativity, right? Or maybe not kills, but it hides the kernel of what made that thing happen, which is creativity, which is art. And I think that's why I almost in some ways, like on my Twitter bio or my channel descriptions, like, I just have three words. It's art, continental philosophy, and theory. And I put art at the top, actually, because I think that's like the most important thing is I want to impart that, like, things like art, creativity, those things like really fucking matter. The best things that humanity has to offer is art. Like, it just is. I mean, we can try some logical fucking, I don't know, like, we can try to kind of disprove that theory, and I've tried it. I can't. I think try to make life, if you can approach things, I think, more artistically, I don't know, I think that would make the world a better place, if you know. But that's kind of like, that's my thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I agree. I think that there's an absence of that in a lot of people's lives.
Yep.
And we do also have evidence from my psychology background that creativity is a pretty strong, there's pretty strong evidence that, you know, it's an adaptive trait and it serves a lot of different purposes.
Right.
Any final thoughts on our conversation?
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot. And I'm sure for a lot of people who aren't exactly, you know, embedded in philosophy, that might be a bit difficult to come to grips with. There's a lot there. I guess I can say that, like, I would offer, I used to do this more in the past if I was on anyone else's podcast, like, feel free to reach out to me. Really, in good faith, I don't think I can say that. I get bombarded with messages all the time. I'm sorry. I probably won't even be able to get back. I would say, I guess maybe watch some videos if you're curious about. And I know that just sounds weird. It's like, oh yeah, dude, like, if you don't understand me, go do the thing that makes me money, or go help me out with this. No, but like, if they're, you know, take the opportunity to learn some things within critical theory, philosophy at large, a lot of other wonderful channels, Plastic Pills, Theory and Philosophy, Then and Now. I think it can really add a level of language to how we can think of the world. And I think that's pretty cool. And I hope that more people do that. And whether that's through me, whether that's through other YouTubers, whether that's through academic institutions, I think being curious, being artistic, I think those are good things that I think it would make me happy to see more of. And I guess if I can impart anything, maybe that. Those are my final thoughts.
Excellent. And I would like to say my final thoughts are, first, I want to thank you for joining me on my podcast/channel. Everyone, if you're listening or watching, definitely go check out your channel, Epoch Philosophy, or Epic, however you want to pronounce it. It really does have this quality where there's an optimism and hope in your voice, even. And even these grim topics you talk about, you somehow seem to make them. It's really hard to explain in words almost, but you present them in a way where they bring something to the world and expand the just the flow of information in a very positive way.
That's awesome. I can
boil it down to something.
That's a wonderful compliment.
It's a very nice aura that your channel creates. Uh-huh. Yeah, those are my final thoughts. Have a good night and thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, to write a song that has no meaning at all, that doesn't touch a personal nerve or heed a social call, that knows no up or down, that has no right or wrong, that doesn't need a reason to waste some time with song, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I'll sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Doesn't let it all hang out, that doesn't wave any flag or have any slogan to shout, that knows no east or west, that has no left or right, that doesn't throw any stones or look for any fight, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I'll sing ba ba cha ba ben, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just to write a song that won't mend a broken heart, that won't woo you like a lover or promise a brand new start, that doesn't preach of rain and fire or heed any higher call, that doesn't need a reason to mean nothing at all, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba 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 ba, whoa, whoa, whoa. Just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba 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 ba, whoa, whoa, whoa. Ba 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 ba, whoa, whoa, whoa. Ba 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 ba, whoa, whoa.